Think straight. This morning, first of all, we'd like to observe some Old Testament characters dealing with their dead. Then we'll look at some New Testament characters. And from there, we'll look at some other cultures and other religions and how they deal with this issue. And finally, we'll conclude with some practical observations for us today. Now, I know some of you may be wondering how a sermon like this could be inspirational. Well, I accept the challenge to provoke your thought, to give you something to carry away from here. Hopefully, you can be stimulated to do some God-fearing thinking of your own. For a beginning, turn with me to Ecclesiastes 7. We'll read verses 1 through 5. He says in Ecclesiastes 7, 1 to 5, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now, brothers and sisters, I think we have a problem with that verse. We tend to think that the day of one's birth is better than the day of one's death. Let's move on. He says, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. Again, we have a problem with that. We think it's better to go to the house of feasting than to go to the house of mourning. Now, he gives a reason for this. He says, for that's the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Herein lies some of the inspiration I would like to leave with you this morning, although we're not going to be talking about this per se. Life is real, life is serious, and the grave is not its goal. Dust to thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. And the fact is, and I'm 53 and I think more about it than I used to, the fact is every single one of us here, unless Christ comes, is going to lay our head down and die someday. And so this is a real issue. Many, many times people tend to avoid this very real issue and think about other things. And whenever babies are born, we think about promise, we think about future, we think about possibility, we think about potential. And that's all right and good too. But the babies who are born will someday die. He says at the end of this verse, the living will lay it to his heart. And so it's wise for all of us to think about dying. Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. Here again, we have a problem with this verse. We think that laughter is better than sorrow. But he gives the reason why. He says, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. Well, if we're interested in pleasing God, if we're interested in that which is going to endure, as we heard in a devotional this morning, well, then we're going to be thinking about sorrow and the real issues of life because we want something that's going to be better forever. Verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. But we have a problem with that. We don't think so. But the scripture does say the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It seems that when people get together, they have to think about things that are funny, things that make each other laugh. This is especially true for young people. But the scripture says, God says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Verse 5. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. And we've already heard some discussion about wise and fools here, so I think he's re-emphasizing what's been said here. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This is also vanity. And so when thorns are burned in the fire, they crackle. That's as far as it goes. But the wise is going to lay it to heart. And so let that be a preface to some of the things we say this morning. And let that be some of the inspiration we can carry with us from this place. Now we're already in the book of Ecclesiastes, so let's go back one chapter to chapter 6. In verse 3, like I said, we're going to focus on dealing with dead bodies this morning. Verse 3, he says, "If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good," that's one thing, we understand that. But look what he says next. "And also that he have no burial." We don't usually think about that. But he says, "I say that an untimely birth is better than he." In other words, it's better to be stillborn or have a premature birth than it is not to be buried. Wow. Have you ever thought that? But that's what the scripture writer says. So burial is important. Now, one of the issues we have to deal with on this thing of dead bodies is the subject of cremation. We're going to be talking quite a bit about that a little bit later. But you know, as far as I know, there's only one reference in the Bible to cremation. So we're going to look at that one right up front. Turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 31. And we'll read the story. "Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Melchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. Then said Saul unto his armor-bearer, Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men that same day together. And when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side of Jordan, saw the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head, and stripped off his armor, and sent it into the land of the Philistines round about, to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, which is their god, one of their gods, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan for a public display of their triumph. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. Pause to note in verse 11, it says that the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul. In verse 12, the valiant men went and took the body of Saul. And I think these two verses just simply state what we always feel. I have a body right now. I'm living right now. But if I would die and my spirit would leave, my body is still here, I think at least my wife and my children would still call me by my first name, even though technically I'm not here. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important because even though my body is not really me, it is very much a part of me. We are body, soul, spirit. We're three. But we don't say that the body is completely separated from the other two. It's just the less important. I think forever, in the new heavens and the new earths, we're going to be reunited with this body. And I don't know how it's all going to be, but my guess is we'll be able to recognize each other in the bodies we have. It's just that the infirmities that are associated with our bodies will be fixed, forever and gloriously fixed, and there won't be any problems anymore. And so, I'll get ahead of myself. I'll just leave that. But you do notice that they did burn their bodies. And this is the only time that cremation is mentioned in the scriptures that I know of. If you know of any other situations, I would invite you to share them with me. But the reason for cremation was not because it was a normal thing to do. It was an exigency. It was something that needed to be done. They needed to rescue these bodies from the enemies, and they did, and cremated them after they got them. Go with me now to Genesis chapter 23. We'd like to go to Sarah's funeral first this morning. Abraham's wife Sarah. Begin reading at verse 1 of chapter 23. And Sarah was 107 and 20 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, the same as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham stood up from before his dead and spake unto the sons of Heth, saying, now, jump over to verse 19. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, the same as Hebron in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that is therein were made sure unto Abraham for a possession of a burying place by the sons of Heth. Now I said, come with me to Sarah's funeral. What funeral do you see there? Is there a funeral? Well, the concept of funeral is not in the Old Testament. We'll look more about that a little bit later, but I'd like to point out a couple things to you. First of all, when this lady died, when Sarah died, Abraham came to mourn for her and to weep for her. There's sadness and a sense of loss that Abraham experienced when he lost his wife. In verse 3, he faced the predicament. He says he stood up from before his dead. I don't know what all he was doing. If he was caressing, touching Sarah, caressing her in her death, or what? But he says he stood up from before his dead, and he had a problem. He needs to bury his dead. He needs to put this dead body someplace. The disposal of a dead body. And the verses we did not read is the story of how he found a place to put Sarah's dead body. And once he had that secured, then he buried his wife in the cave. Actually, that's what he did. He bought a field that had a cave in it, and he put his wife's body in this cave. And he made sure he got a deed to this field for a possession of a burying place. We would call it today a cemetery. He got a cemetery. Now, let's go on to Abraham's own story. If you go to chapter 25, beginning at verse 7. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, 103 years. Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Now we're going to get that term a little later, gathered to his people. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre. That's the same place that he buried Sarah, the cemetery, the field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth. There was Abraham buried and Sarah his wife. Again, do you see any funeral? There's no funeral. One of the reasons for no funeral back in those days was when someone died, they need to be buried soon because the body would be decomposed and they had no embalming possibilities like we have today. And so they need to be buried soon. Well, how could visitors and people from a distance come in and see the dead body if it was already decomposing? So that the natural thing to do was just to find a place to dispose of the body and take care of it. Of course, the mourning and lamenting followed afterwards. All right. We'll talk more about properly disposing of the dead. All right, now let's go to another death situation in chapter 49 of Genesis. This time, we'll look at Jacob. The last verse of chapter 49. It says, "And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people." There's that term again, gathered unto his people. Now let me just pause and talk about that term just a bit. Another way of saying gathered unto his people would be he took his place in Sheol, or the place of departed spirits. And the Jews understood Sheol as the shadowy region where souls had left that had left the mortal body continued their existence. In Sheol. And Peter says in 1 Peter 3:19, that is where Jesus went to preach to the spirits in prison. In the time that after Jesus died and before he resurrected, he went down to Sheol and preached to the departed spirits. All right, now let's leaving that and picking up where we left off in chapter 50. And Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. Now there we see grief expressed. We see Joseph dealing with a dead body. He's actually kissing a dead body. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. Now that's different from Abraham and Sarah. But remember that this story is in Egypt. And in Egypt, the Egyptians believed that for the soul to be immortal, it had to be preserved. The body had to be preserved. And so in that sense, the Egyptians were different from a number of other peoples we'll look at today. But they Joseph applied the practice of the Egyptians to his father, and so they embalmed him. And 40 days were fulfilled for him. For so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed. Now, let me just pause here a little bit. Back in those days in Egypt, what they did was opened up the body cavity and took the insides out and put them in jars. And the jars had little gods on them, I suppose, who were supposed to take care of the insides. The rest of the body was treated with spices and rosins and salt and all kinds of other things that they put in there. And then, of course, it was wrapped. And some of this mummification was so complete that we can still see mummies today. Mummies who had died 4,000 years ago, you can still see that body today. That's how good their embalming was. Verse 4, "And when the days of his mourning were past," in this particular case, the Egyptians mourned for him for 70 days. And you'll notice in Jacob's case, 40 days. I'm sorry. That was the embalming process. The Egyptians mourned for him 70 days, which is 70 days. "And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Lo, I die. In my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan, there shalt thou bury me. Now therefore, let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come again. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury thy father according as he hath made thee swear." Now pause there a little bit. If Jacob wanted to be buried back in Canaan, and there was no embalming possible, how would they have gotten Jacob's body back to Canaan without having a terrible ordeal? And so we simply see the providence of God. God allowed Jacob to be embalmed so that they would take all the days necessary. And by the way, it's more than just one or two to move from Egypt to the land of Canaan by horse or walking. It was a slow process to get back there. And so Joseph took this very seriously. He did not make a decision for his father otherwise. He honored his father's desire to be buried back in Canaan. And so Pharaoh said, "Go, do what you told your father you would do." Verse 7. And Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the house of Joseph and his brethren and his father's house. Only their little ones and their flocks and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with them both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great and very sore lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. There had been 70 days with the Egyptians. Now it's 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians." Therefore, the name of it was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. And his sons did unto him, or his body, according as he commanded them. For his sons carried him into the land of Canaan, and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, which Abraham bought with the field for a possession of a burying place of Ephron the Hittite before Mamre. That's the same place Abraham and Sarah were buried. It's the family cemetery. And Joseph returned into Egypt, he and his brethren, and all that went up with him to bury his father after he had buried his father. That was quite a funeral situation. Now that's more of a funeral like we're used to. And I think every one of us sitting here, if we would have a, if one of us would die and only two or three people would come to the funeral, I just think that's one of the biggest insults that could be. When I go to a funeral and I see lots and lots of cars and lots of people, the first thing that comes to my mind is this person was loved and respected. I was just recently up in McConnellsville, Ohio, and Raymond Barkman told me, he said, well, we came to a certain intersection in town. He said, when we got here, they stopped all the traffic, and the 150 cars went by whenever my wife went to the cemetery. That just blessed me. I don't know how many people were in all those cars, but it was a very great company who came to the funeral of that lady. All right, let's move on to another death. Let's go to Numbers chapter 20. We'll start reading at verse 25. Take Aaron and Eleazar his son, and bring them up unto Mount Hor. And strip Aaron of his garments, and put them upon Eleazar his son. And Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, and shall die there. And Moses did as the Lord commanded, and they went up into Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. Let me pause here. I'm wondering if this wasn't announced on ahead of time, that Aaron is going up into this mountain to die. I don't know, it doesn't really say, but I wouldn't be surprised. They went up into the mountain in the sight of all the congregation. Everybody's watching from down below while this is happening. And Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them upon Eleazar his son. And Aaron died there in the top of the mount. And Moses and Eleazar came down from the mount. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, they mourned for Aaron 30 days, even all the house of Israel. Where's the funeral? There's no funeral. It just simply says that he died. They'd made the transfer, the high priesthood transfer from Aaron to his son, and he died. And that's it. Down below in the valley, we could say they had their funeral. There was mourning for 30 days, even all the house of Israel. Now, his brother Moses, we have to read his story in Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy 34, verses 1 to 8, give that story. And Moses went up from the plains of Moab under the mountain of Nebo to the top of Pisgah that is over against Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead under Dan, and all Naphtali and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah unto the uttermost sea, and the south and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees unto Zoar. And the Lord said unto him, This is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor. No man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. I think that is an outstanding fact. God buried Moses. The disposal of Moses' body was so important that God buried him. I think that the reason nobody knows his sepulcher unto this day is that if people would have known where Moses was buried, they'd have gone there and built something special and tended to worship Moses. And God did not want that. And so God did it in secret. And no one knows today even where that is. Verse 7, And Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Same as Aaron. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. Another death we'll find in 2 Chronicles 16. Begin reading at verse 11 in 2 Chronicles 16. And behold, the acts of Asa, first and last, lo, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Asa, in the 39th year of his reign, was diseased in his feet, until his disease was exceedingly great. Yet in his disease he sought not to the Lord, but to the physicians. And Asa slept with his fathers. Now, that's another way of saying he died. It doesn't say gathered to his people here. It says he slept with his fathers. And died in the 140th year of his realm. And they buried him in his own sepulcher. Now here is a special place, which he had made for himself in the city of David, and laid him in the bed, which was filled with sweet odors and divers kinds of spices prepared by the apothecary's art. And they made a very great burning for him. Now let's look at the last part first. They made a very great burning for him. They did not burn this body. Part of their funeral was to make a bonfire. It was a great bonfire. It was a part of the honor that they gave to this man Asa. Here we have a move from the cave as a place to bury to evidently a sepulcher that this man prepared for himself, for his body to be laid in. And you'll notice that in this place, it was not just something cold and barren. It was filled with sweet odors. It was perfumed and spiced, prepared by the apothecary's art. There was special preparation put into the place where this man's body was to lie. This man was loved. Now let's go to chapter 21 in the same book, verses 16 to 20. Moreover, the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines and of the Arabians that were near the Ethiopians. And they come up into Judah and break into it and carried away all the substance that was found in the king's house, and his sons also and his wives, so that there was never a son left him. In other words, he killed them all except Jehoahaz, the youngest of his sons. And after all this, the Lord smote him in his bowels with an incurable disease. And it came to pass that in the process of time, after the end of 2 years, his bowels fell out by reason of his sickness. So he died of sore diseases. And his people made no burning for him like the burning of his fathers. The reason this man was despised. And so they did not honor him with a bonfire. 32 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 8 years and departed without being desired. Howbeit, they buried him in the city of David, but not in the sepulchers of the kings. This man's life did not merit a proper place in the good part of the cemetery, the honored cemetery, which indicates that even in death, people place us, place our bodies according to the way we lived our lives. Now, in our situations today, we don't have cemeteries that are marked out with good, fair, and poor. And you put the poor testimony people in the poor section, the people with the good testimony in the good section. That would be an insult. But back in these days, they at least recognized that this man was a wicked man. And he did not deserve to be buried with good kings. I just think that the middle part of this verse here, I just think this is one of the most awful things that could be said. If I would die, and people would say, good riddance, at least he's gone. Why was I alive? And again, one of the best testimonies for any one of us is if our funerals are large. We're loved, desired. Now, we looked at enough situations, funeral situations in the Old Testament. Let's go to New Testament. First of all, Luke chapter 8. Verse 49 of Luke 8. This is the death of a little girl. And while he yet spake, I know we're not reading the whole story here. While he yet spake, there came one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, thy daughter is dead. Trouble not the master. But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole. And when he came into the house, he suffered no man to go in save Peter and James and John, and the father and mother of the maiden. Six people in there. And all wept and bewailed her. It's like the mourning has begun. But he said, weep not. She's not dead, but sleepeth. And they laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. And then he put them all out, just Jesus himself, and took her by the hand and called, saying, maid, arise. And her spirit came again, and she arose straightway, and he commanded to give her meat. And her parents were astonished, but he charged them that they should tell no man what was done. Now notice, in the raising of this little girl, he gave her his hand and said, maid, arise. This girl had died very recently, and she was a little girl. Now compare that with the next story, in Luke chapter 7, go back one chapter, beginning at verse 11. And it came to pass the day after that he went into the city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and much people. And when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And much people of the city was with her. This was a loved lady, or a loved young man. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, weep not. And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said, young man, I say unto thee, arise. And he that was dead sat up and began to speak, and he delivered him to his mother. And I would like to notice several things here. First of all, this young man had been dead longer than the little girl. He was dead long enough that they had wrapped him up. Does it say wrap here? I guess it doesn't. Well, at least he was put on something, and they were carrying this out of the city. They had enough time. The Jewish custom was to wash the body and to properly clothe it, and evidently it was exposed. It was not inside a casket with a lid down. It was being carried out to be put into the grave, and Jesus stopped it. And so they stood still, and he said, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." I would have loved to listen to the voice inflections. Did Jesus say to the little girl, "Maid, arise"? The young man was older and was further into death. He had to stop the procession. Did he say, possibly just a little bit louder, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise"? Because I don't think Jesus went over and took him by the hand. He just stopped the bier. He did touch the bier. Doesn't say whether they left it down. I would have thought they were carrying it up on their shoulders, but maybe that's just my thought. But he did say, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." More words, at least. Okay, now John chapter 11 for Lazarus' situation. Begin with verse 14. We won't read the whole story here. Verse 14 in John chapter 11. "Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. His body is dead." Now go to verse 28. "And when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary her sister secretly, saying, The Master is come and calleth for thee. As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. And the Jews then, which were with her in the house, and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she arose hastily and went out, followed her, saying, She goeth unto the grave to weep there. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was, and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her." It's like a funeral here. "He groaned in the spirit and was troubled." Now the other time when the little girl died, he was not troubled. He said, "Don't worry, the girl is just sleeping." But here, Jesus is groaning in the spirit and is troubled. And I would like to wonder why. I don't think we have a complete answer. But anyway, verse 34, "And said, Where have ye laid him? Where have you put his body? And they said unto him, Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Jesus entered into the sorrow of these Jews in some way. And I would love to explore that thought, but that's not the sermon this morning, so we'll just leave that. "Then said the Jews, Behold how he loved him. And some of them said, Could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died? Jesus therefore, again groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, Take ye away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days. Jesus saith unto her, Said I not unto thee that if thou wouldst believe, thou shouldst see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And when thus he had thus spoken," now get this, "he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. And Jesus saith unto them, Loose him, and let him go." Now we'll stop reading there. Now Lazarus had been buried 4 days. He was much farther into death. Could I say much farther away from his body? He was an older person than either the maid or the young man. And Jesus needed to call the dead spirit back with a loud voice. And of course it came. And of course, he was bound up in grave clothes at this in this particular account. It doesn't give that, I guess, on the little girl. They didn't have time to do anything with her. But the young man, they're at least carrying him out, but it doesn't say anything about grave clothes. But here, Lazarus is really wrapped up. This is what they did with Lazarus' body. Now, what about the funerals here in the New Testament? Do we find funerals? Well, again, they didn't have embalming. Immediate burial would not allow for funerals like we have. They did have mourning, as we've noticed. But again, you'll notice there's no cremation in this picture. None. The body is respected, and it's placed in a grave or a tomb. Now let's go to Jesus' story himself for his own body and read 38 to 42 of chapter 19. We're breaking into the story here. And after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. Now Jesus' body is hanging on the cross at this point. And Pilate gave him leave. He came therefore and took the body of Jesus. And there came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100-pound weight. 100-pound weight. I don't think that's exactly the same as our pounds, but that's a lot of spices. Then they took the body of Jesus and wound it in linen clothes, a little bit like Lazarus was wound, with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now, by this time, there's a tradition among the Jews in how you take care of dead bodies. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new sepulcher, wherein was never man yet laid. There they laid Jesus. Now, again, they didn't lay Jesus' body. It says they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulcher was nigh at hand. Now, you don't need to turn to this, but let me read something to you from Deuteronomy chapter 21 as to why Joseph of Arimathea came and asked if he could have this body. In Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23, it says, "If a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and thou hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day." And then there's parentheses, "For he that is hanged is accursed of God, that thy land be not defiled, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance." Now that is a very interesting statement. It indicates that bodies should not be left to exposure, especially hanging on a tree in a place of shame, that the land be defiled. Now that's Old Testament. But it's significant that God felt that way even in the Old Testament. Now let's go to the New Testament. In Revelation 11, you may turn to this. Brother Leland didn't get to this yet. And I don't think he'll talk about this whenever he gets there. But let's just notice something in chapter 11, verses 7 to 10. This is in relation to the two witnesses. "And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast shall that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. And they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and shall not suffer their bodies to be put into graves." They shall not suffer their bodies to be put into graves, which is suggesting a shameful thing. Verse 10, "And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry and shall send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt upon the earth." And then it goes on that these bodies are resurrected. But you'll notice that it was improper that the bodies were left out to exposure. All right, now we're going to leave the Bible aside now and think about some facts of relating to bodies. I got this from the Encyclopedia Britannica. If you want to check up on me, you can check in the encyclopedia back here. It says this: "It is the culture, often more particularly the religion, of any particular group that defines and institutionalizes the meaning of death." The attitude toward death and the dead reflects on the general life of the individual and the group. And that's well said. That's just the way it is. Now the question is, does God have an attitude that He's transmitted to us through His Word about how we should deal with dead bodies? The variety of death customs is immense. Now, I'm going to be mentioning six of them here. But we in our Christian culture only deal with one of them. But we are only one of the many peoples in the world and throughout history. But I think that we've already noticed about God's people, God has some things in mind for a dead body. Think about these things. First of all, interment, or we call that burial. This is the oldest method. Usually, the body is in extended position. It's laid out, like it's sleeping. Sometimes, though, sitting or standing. Immediate contact with earth. It could be laid right in a dirt grave, or it could be protected by matting, stones, or a coffin. And for us, we wouldn't think of putting a dead body into a hole in the ground. We would think about putting it in some kind of box. Muslims are laid on their right side facing Mecca. Buddhists, where they bury, lie face upward with the head to the north. Christian tradition prefers the feet to the east. How many of you knew that? That Christian cemeteries put if this is a dead body, and this is the feet and the head, that if the body would stand up on its feet, it would face the east. How many of you knew that? Okay, very good. Now, whether that's actually going to be the case or not, I don't know, but that is a tradition among Christian people. Ready to rise and meet Christ when He appears on the Mount of Olives. Cave burial, mass graves for wartime dead or major catastrophes are other places where they put people in the ground. And memorials have varied from simple stones or even to pieces of wood to sumptuous mausoleums. And you go by graveyards and you could still see that today. I think one of the sad things is, and just recently we were in a graveyard, some of the poor people years ago were so poor that whenever they had a funeral, they couldn't even afford a headstone. So they got a piece of rock from their farm and somehow scratched or wrote or something on that stone and stuck it in there. Today, the stone is there. You can see this is a grave, but that's it. There's no information on it. It's lost. In more recent years, they tried putting marble in. Well, now marble hasn't stood up under the weathering process, and people are losing what's written on the marble stones. But they have granite now, which will probably stand a test of time. Secondly, cremations. First one was burial. The next one is cremation. Now, think about this. Listen carefully, brothers and sisters. The Greeks popularized this. This concept of creation did not come from God's people or from God. And when Christianity came into the Roman Empire, in the late Roman Empire, it pushed cremation out. Because Christians understood that the body is to be respected. Now, in more recent times, there is now another return and a revival of cremation. It's also significant that cremation is the usual method for Hindus and Buddhists. And as I mentioned earlier, Egypt excluded cremation because they believed that immortality depended upon the preservation of the body. If we didn't preserve the body, the spirit couldn't live either. Now, when it comes to cremation, cremation can be complete or incomplete. And in the story of Saul that we read here this morning, after Saul and his sons' bodies were burned, it says they took up the ashes and then they buried them. So you can have complete cremation or incomplete cremation. And in Saul's case, it was incomplete cremation. Today, the details of the procedure are regulated by tradition or sanitary requirements. Number three, conservation. This is the preservation of the whole body. We've already talked about the mummies of Egypt, but we practice this one today, conservation. We embalm. At least most of our people are embalmed. I don't think I've ever been to a funeral where there was no embalming. Now, I understand in Central America they do that, but I've never been to one of those. And we have gotten so good at this in our day that Lenin's body, the father of communism, his body was so well preserved and put under a glass case. It was put in Red Square for people, devoted communists, to walk past and look at his dead body for 65 years. Now, recently, since communism fell, they took him out of Red Square. My question is he still someplace where you could go see him yet today? It might be. He died in 1924, and I know that he was on display up through 1989. Now, whether he's still on display today or not, I'm not sure. Number four, water burial. This is a simple way to dispose of a body. It was often applied to slaves, to foreigners, or people considered of no account. Just dump them in the water. Put a stone on them, tie a stone onto their feet, dump them in. That's it. And in the Western world, among our civilization, this is the way you are buried if you died at sea. And some of our people had this. On our way over to America from Europe, some of us died on the way here. And you don't carry dead bodies on ships. If a dead body dies, you have a simple service on board, and then you bury at sea. Number five, exposure. Now, this is what was shameful that I've already indicated from the scriptures. And exposure means allowing a corpse to decay on the ground or in trees, on rocks, on special platforms, or to be devoured by animals. And some of the American Indians, this was their practice. If a body died, they built a scaffold in the trees and put the body up there. Now, some Buddhists prefer exposure. Now, get this. As an act of charity to hungry animals and birds. Now, if you're an Eskimo, when the ground is frozen, that's your only possibility for exposure. So the body is left in a frozen situation until spring comes, then the body is thawed out and then it's buried. And last one, this was a new one to me, cannibalism. It's called endocannibalism of relatives. Not foreigners or strangers, but when a person dies, the relatives actually eat part of him. Supposedly to ensure that the dead remains in closest possible union with the tribe. Often, the sick and the old are killed and their flesh is ceremonially eaten. You say, where has this ever happened? I never heard of this before. What's found in Australia? That's far away. South America? That's far away. In Africa? And that's far away. And that's why we don't know anything about it. All right, now, we'll look at some death practices, and this is not exhaustive at all. It's brief. First of all, we'll look at the Muslims. And again, I know I'm not getting everything, but at the approach of death, a Muslim pronounces the profession of faith together with Surah 36 of the Quran. Now, that's like chapter 36 in our Bible. He pronounces that over the dead body. The body is laid on a stretcher in the direction of Mecca, and reverently and carefully washed according to very precise regulations. Body orifices are stuffed with cotton and the body sprinkled with camphor and rose water. Eyes are closed and the feet are tied. And the body is dressed in an odd number of shrouds, never an even number, and I don't know why. And there's a prayer for the dead and it's minutely prescribed and they have to recite that particular prayer over the dead. Martyrs are not washed and are not prayed over. A watch over the body is usual, and the Quran is recited by hired readers. That is the Muslim practice. The Jewish practice we've already been looking at in the scriptures here, partly, and I'll read some more here. Now get this. This comes from the encyclopedia. Interment in one's own country and with one's fathers. Evidently, that's still important to Jews today. To be deprived of a proper burial was considered a major disaster. And exposure was such a disgrace that even criminals were spared. You just do not leave a body out there to be exposed to the animals or on the street or in the gutter. You just don't do that. To be properly lamented over was almost as important as burial. Preparing the body and mourning over it were considered meritorious acts of charity. The corpse was buried in the extended position, means laid out, like you're sleeping, in a plain wooden coffin or a grave lined with stone slabs. And then the returning from the burial, the mourners partook of a funeral meal. Okay, Christian, number four. This is one we're most familiar with it, but I'd like to mention a couple things that you may not be familiar with. I found this extremely interesting. Mourning over death or a dead body was not an original Christian custom. Because the Christians understood the deceased had merely left this temporary abode in order to join his Lord in glory and to expect the final resurrection. In the 300s yet, brothers and sisters, funerals were still joyous occasions, and those attending wore white. By the 700s, when Europe was descending into darkness without the Bible, the Christian world had changed, and funerals were occasions of mourning, and they wore black. But at the beginning, it was not so. I think we have something to learn there. Number four, Hinduism. At approach of death, the relatives and Brahmins, which are their holy men, are called. Mantras and sacred texts are recited and ceremonial gifts prepared. It's desirable that the dying person touch a cow, which is then given to a Brahmin. Since the time of the Rig Veda, cremation has been the usual method of disposal. Cremation is performed near a river on a funeral pyre. Now, a funeral pyre is where you gather a whole bunch of wood together, make a huge pile of wood, and then you place the body on top of this. It's called a funeral pyre. And then you burn it. And I know that throughout the years, it has developed that while, for example, if it was a husband who was being burned, sometimes the living wife would come and run and throw herself up on the pyre too, to be burnt to death with her husband. Now, they've outlawed that in India today. For 10 days after the funeral, the mourners are unclean and secluded from society. They must perform various rituals. Number five, Buddhists. They cremate. Often the body is embalmed or buried for a period of time before cremation. And I don't understand that, but that's the way they do. Now get this. Death is painful and inevitable, and all men fear it. But it's not like we fear it. See, Buddhism has this concept of reincarnation, and they just finished one cycle. When somebody dies, it means they have to go through another one. So the sorrow is in terms of what they're going to have to be reborn as. Its real sting is the fact that it's not the end, but a new beginning, a birth of a new existence. Meditation on death is necessary to enlightenment. Enlightened men no longer pass. I mean, Buddhism is so far astray from Christianity and what God says. If you're really enlightened as a Buddhist, you no longer pass into a new existence, but into extinction and release from existence. It's called nirvana. You see, the whole hope of a Buddhist is to finally get to be nothing. Isn't that strange? Christianity says the best is yet to come if we're with Christ. They look forward to nothingness. The Buddhists reject the idea of a substantial soul. All right, practical conclusions. I have more material here than I'm going to be able to finish sharing, but I'd like to share at least a few things. Number one, the body, our bodies, are the temple of the Holy Ghost and are to be treated as such even after its spirit departs. And even as we do not mutilate the body in death, we do not mutilate it in life. We do not mutilate it in death. And so the question arises then, why would we cremate it? If we don't mutilate, why would we cremate? In the beginning, God made our bodies good out of the dust of the ground. Secondly, viewing and funerals are opportunities to pay last respects to the dead and to their families. We honor a person by attending his or her viewing or funeral. If people do not go to a viewing or a funeral, I know we have to all make judgments about this. But choosing to go to a viewing or a funeral is a statement of honor and respect. Of course, the dead can't see it, but it's to the living. I didn't have time, but there are, on page 127 and 128 in the minister's manual, there are I'm just going to read a little bit. I won't read everything. You probably heard this at a funeral. Forasmuch as it has pleased Almighty God and His wise providence to take out of this world the soul of the departed, we commit the body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and commit the soul to God who gave it, looking for the general resurrection in the last day and the life of the world to come through our Lord Jesus Christ. And it goes on. And I don't know what you're used to, but sometimes I think a minister takes dirt in his hands and drops it as part of that. Very appropriate. Barbara and I visited the Clayton K. Funeral Home here a few years ago to learn about our options in funerals. And Mr. Chuck Lee was very helpful and expressed readiness to work with us in any way that we would desire. And he had mentioned 10 points here. If you'll let me, I'll just read these briefly so you can hear at least the thought in these 10 points. He says, if we would use any other casket than what would be purchased from them, we would need to sign a release form, relieving them of any legal responsibility. And we have, I have right here in this pack, their casket prices as well as Billy Baltozer's casket prices. Billy Baltozer was a man in the church I came from in Pennsylvania who made caskets or coffins. We would have the privilege of making our own casket. If somebody here wants to make your own casket, it's acceptable. Number two, if we would only use the funeral home's embalming service and conduct the viewing and funeral service ourselves, again, we would need to sign a release form, relieving them of any legal responsibility. The funeral director assumes legal responsibility for a body until it is buried. Number three, the embalming price is $385. He said babies are hard to embalm. Embalming after autopsies need follow-up attention for leakage. Number four, our cemetery, and this is a grand view, has been entered into the land record, but it needs to have a fence around it. The fence shows the location of the cemetery. Now that's like a public place, but if I'm understanding it correctly, anybody can bury on their own property, even today. Number five, a baby born prematurely needs no death certificate before 20 weeks of gestation. After 20 weeks, a death certificate is needed. Number six, Texas law gives 24 hours from time of death until embalming, refrigeration, burial, or cremation takes place. If cremation, it takes 2 days to obtain permits. Number seven, no vault is necessary in a private cemetery. Local cemeteries create the rules. Usually, cemeteries require vaults simply to keep the ground surface level. Okay, now number eight, he stressed this one, and I'd like to stress this for all of us. In case of death at home or anywhere, do not touch the body until it has been examined by the medical examiner. Just let it alone. In Johnson County, the medical examiner, the coroner, must be called from Cleburne. He can only be reached from Monday through Friday during working hours. If the call comes after working hours or on a weekend, 911 must be called. In that event, an ambulance, police, and fire trucks all come out. The body most likely will be taken to a hospital for examination by a medical examiner. Number 10, if death is imminent, get a doctor involved so that an autopsy can be prevented. Did you hear that? If you don't want an autopsy, make sure you have a doctor there before the person dies. Number 10, if an autopsy is involved, Tarrant County autopsies 75% of all unattended deaths. There may be a question as to whom the body is released, the funeral director or the family. Release to a family would be much more difficult to accomplish. Okay, I don't want to elaborate on that. I'm not sure if I got this from him or someplace, but what should you say to the people who are still alive, who lost a loved one. Here are 14 things. What can I say? I know I felt already in the presence of death to the living. What do you say? He mentions, and I don't have time to read them, but there's a lot of 14 different ones. You may check with me further if you're interested in that. Let me conclude this morning by reading this. I read of a man who stood to speak at the funeral of his friend. He referred to the dates on her tombstone from the beginning to the end. He noted that first came the date of her birth and spoke of the second with tears. But he said what mattered most of all was the dash between those years. For that dash represented all the time that she spent alive on earth. And now only the ones who loved her know what that little line is worth. For it matters not how much we own, the cars, the house, the cash. What matters is how we live and love and how we spend our dash. So think about this long and hard. Are there things you'd like to change? For you never know how much time is left. You could be at dash mid-range. If we could just slow down enough to consider what's true and what's real, and always try and understand the way other people feel, and be less quick to anger, and show appreciation more, and love the people in our lives like we never loved before. If we treat each other with respect, and more often wear a smile, remembering that this special dash might only last a little while. So, when your eulogy is being read with your life's actions to rehash, would you be pleased with what they have to say about how you spent your dash? Let's kneel as we pray.